This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
This week on Meatin' 3, it's the final episode of our series on global trade. We're thinking futuristically, from China's ambitious plans for a new Silk Road to the future of borders and automation.
If you're a banana, you know, it's easy to cross the border. But if you're a person who's trying to follow the jobs, it's a lot more difficult, if not impossible, to do so in an authorized and safe fashion.
They love food trucks and they love growing your own food because these things are not dependent on essentially government systems. So there's a whole politics to pretzels on the dark web.
Tune in to Meatin' 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host for the week, Melissa Fuster. This episode is part of a special series in collaboration with Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies. Our new issue, 21.1, features articles on food and power, on care work, and on chefs, restaurants, and culinary creativity. As well, Gastronomica continues to publish its COVID dispatches, which are short portraits of early responses to the food crisis of this pandemic. For 6 weeks, join us as hosts from the Gastronomica Editorial Collective as we talk with authors. My guest this week is Amy Bentley, joining us to discuss her piece, Ketchup as a Vegetable, Condiments and the Politics of School Lunch in Reagan's America. Amy is professor of food studies at New York University and author of several books and other publications. Her most recent book is Inventing Baby Food, Taste, Health, and the Industrialization of the American Diet, published by the University of California Press in 2014. Her current research projects include a history of food in American hospitals and the Food and COVID-19 NYC Digital Archive. Thank you for joining us, Amy, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here and really nice to chat with you today.
Thank you. So I would like us to begin by getting our listeners to learn more about your work. If you can just start by telling us what first motivated your interest in food and history.
I was in graduate school at the University of Pennsylvania in an American Studies program and was looking for a topic to write my dissertation on, and I was in the Library of Congress, looking around for materials, and I asked the archivist, I said, do you have anything on victory gardens? Because I had remembered my mother's story when she was a girl during World War II, when their family lived in Oakland, California, and had a victory garden and some other stories. And I knew I wanted to write about World War II and food, and women, but I didn't really know in what capacity. Anyway, the archivist said, let me go check. And he came back later wheeling boxes and boxes of material. He said, there is so much here, and I'm not sure anyone has looked at it. And, that's like a historian's dream. Mm-hmm. And the project, my dissertation project, turned into a cultural history of World War II food rationing with emphasis on women's experiences. And that turned into my first book, Eating for Victory. I was teaching at Colorado, University of Colorado, and then the NYU Food Studies program opened up, and I was very, very fortunate to be hired. And just my whole research area turned to focusing on food, the cultural, social, economic, sociopolitical aspects of food, and it's just been a pure delight. There are endless topics to research and teach about and think about. And so my area research emphasis is 20th century United States history, so cultural histories of food. And this article really just fit right into that research area perfectly.
Yeah, and that is what I wanted to ask you next. And just to give our listeners a little bit of a background about your article, So the article that we're going to be talking about talks about the 1981 Reagan administration efforts to slash budgets across all federal agencies. And I like that you emphasize that except the Department of Defense, which led to proposed cuts in the National School Lunch Program that have since been associated with the ketchup as a vegetable debacle. Given the proposal within to count condiments such as relish and tomato paste as part of the mandated vegetable servings. So I wanted to ask you again, and it does seem to be, of course, a logical fit within your work, but what motivated you to go deep into ketchup and the Reagan administration?
Mm-hmm. I've always been fascinated by cultural meanings of food, iconic food products and the hold that they have in American, primarily American culture. So, you know, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, you know, those icons have very, very broad meanings that are accessible to most people and very specific meanings in American culture and history. And I think ketchup is also one of those ubiquitous American food products, condiments, that has a lot of meaning and accessibility to everybody. And when I was looking for a research topic, I was thinking about those iconic food brands and how they were planted in particular moments of history. And actually, the other one I looked up first to research was Kool-Aid, because I'm on the tail end of the baby boomers, and so I was a teenager in the 1970s and in college in the early 1980s. And perhaps listeners will remember the or have heard of the Jim Jones church in South America and the terrible debacle over in part they were given Kool-Aid to drink that was laced with cyanide, and I was thinking, well, maybe I can research Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out what was it about Kool-Aid, this ubiquitous American drink that was so embedded in this horrible experience. And it was just a little too morbid for me to research. Maybe I'll come back to it at some point. But it also got me thinking about other food products with iconic moments in American politics and culture at around the same time. And ketchup, if you were conscious at that time, or perhaps you remember later, this very powerful moment in the Reagan administration when the press was reporting they were trying to make ketchup count as a vegetable in kids' school lunches, and it just sounded crazy and offensive, and it created a huge uproar. And then became this metaphor for some of the cold-hearted, cruel, approaches to government programs or the coldness through which the Reagan administration viewed American citizens. And so I thought, well, maybe I can research that. Maybe I can try to do a deep dive into that moment and really understand what was going on. Did they really try to make ketchup a vegetable? And if not, why did it get construed that way? So I did do a geeky deep dive into the whole moment and just enjoyed every minute of it, accessing the National Register, the Federal Register, all the newspaper articles, trying to track down and interview people if I could. And then thinking about kind of matching the cultural profound meaning that ketchup has in American culture and linking that to this moment and trying to understand how it all happened and what was the meaning of it.
Yeah, no, and back, thank you for sharing that the first idea around Kool-Aid, because it's interesting that both of these topics are tough contenders, because these are things that even nowadays, we're still talking about, oh, you drank the Kool-Aid.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And then we were still making references of ketchup as a vegetable when we have this crazy nutrition policy idea. So yeah, so I hope you get to write the other piece and we get to talk about it at some point. And in reading your article, and again, I hope that listeners go and read it because it's very, very interesting and it shows that deep dive into the history. And it even motivates some like I became very curious about ketchup and because it is an interesting topic. So in doing your research, what surprised you the most as you were geeking out in the archives and talking with people?
Well, I had to go back and even just figure what the whole story was about and refresh my memory. I was, I think, a freshman in college at the time, so I remember some, but I had to go back and really understand what the Reagan administration was trying to do. And it was part of what was called Reaganomics. Mm-hmm. Reagan was elected, ushered in a whole moment for new economic policy, approaches to welfare, approaches to government programs. And so the budget director and the Congress passed sweeping budget reform, slashing the government budgets, as you said, except for defense, creating what were called block grants, that were the money, the pockets of money, the pools of money were turned back to the states, and the states were supposed to use it as they saw fit, and it was supposed to create more local control. There was the prevailing economic theory called trickle-down economics. Mm-hmm. There's another word for it, but trickle-down, like if tax cuts were a whole part of it. If they slashed taxes, especially for the wealthy, then the wealthy would use that money to stimulate the economy and the benefits would trickle down to the little person, as it were. It's an economic theory that's pretty well proven wrong or proven inaccurate, but it was definitely the prevailing economic theory of the day. And so this is what happened. This is what the Congress did. And part of what they were charged to do was slash the school lunch budget by a third. Mm-hmm. And so they had essentially 12 weeks to figure out how they were going to slash the school lunch budget by a third, yet still, as Congress mandated, maintain the same nutrition benefits of school lunch. So that's just a huge task and arguably impossible, but a task force set about to do that. And in doing so, they dramatically revised the guidelines for what the rules for what a school lunch was supposed to consist of or should consist of. A certain number of a protein, two vegetables, grains, milk. And so there were certain guidelines. And so they set about to reclassify foods to meet those guidelines. Okay. So to fulfill a serving of a grain, the new guidelines said you could use pie or cookies or cake. Chips, they all contain grain, right? Mm-hmm. What was another one? Let's cut out low fat milk. Let's only use whole milk. That'll save money, and it's still milk, right? That so the thinking went. I'm trying to think of another. Oh, so for the protein guideline, introducing non meat sources of protein, so nuts, soy protein, and then. For the vegetable category, the new guideline said, well, we will allow pickle relish to count as a vegetable. We will also allow tomato concentrate to count as a vegetable, I think 2 tablespoons. And they just said tomato concentrate. They didn't say ketchup. They didn't say tomato sauce. They didn't say tomato paste. So I think that was supposed to refer to a concentrate that then would be reconstituted into tomato sauce, like goes on pizza. But given that they also specifically mentioned pickle relish that could be counted as a vegetable, it sort of inserted this idea that condiments could count as one of the vegetable servings. And so whether intended or not, it provided this opening that you could argue that ketchup, a condiment, that a tomato concentrate could then count as a vegetable. And so I think in the haste of creating these guidelines, creating pickle relish as allowing to be a vegetable, which is pretty, like, arguably right there, you have to question the soundness of that, given the salt heavy elements of mm-hmm. relish. It provides this opening to allow ketchup to be counted as a vegetable, whether intended or not. And so when these guidelines were published in the Federal Register, as they were mandated to do a month before, I think, going into effect, I think, immediately the press, consumer groups, others latched onto this aspect of the changes, this idea that ketchup could be counted as a vegetable. Now, this became the headline. As I just said, there were many other questionable mm-hmm. choices for changing the requirements. The pies and cookies and cakes to count as a grain serving. Other things that certainly make more sense today, using soy protein or mm-hmm. butter, nut butters or nuts as protein. But this was the one that became the headline, and that garnered so much attention and so much backlash. It was just in all the papers, on all the TV shows, made fun of, parodies. And in the matter of 3 weeks, the Reagan administration had to pull it back because it was just grabbing all of the oxygen in these recommendations. And so it was a defeat. But it became, as we just talked about, this shorthand for the cold-hearted way that the Reagan administration was approaching school lunches, children, and lower-income people.
Yeah, no, and exactly as you said, when I read your piece, that's something that struck me, that there were so many other things there that were so much worse, like even decreasing the coverage of the lunch from one third, that is supposed to be one meal of the day, to one fourth, right, which is like way worse things than the ketchup. Yeah. So let's first take a break, and we're gonna take a short break. And when we come back, we're gonna take a deeper dive into ketchup and why it is that it was such a big deal in the media in those days.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
And we're back. This is Meant to be Eaten with Melissa Fuster, talking with Amy Bentley about her article, Ketchup as a Vegetable: Condiments and the Politics of School Lunch in Reagan's America, available in the current issue of Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies. Before the break, we started to talk about the whole, how is it that this proposal in 1981 had other things that were much worse than the idea of condiments as vegetables. So I wanted to retake that conversation, Amy. And now, if you can tell us, based on your research, what is it about ketchup that catched the media attention, and how we remember this debacle even today?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, ketchup is very American, and ketchup is very, you could argue, democratic. Most Americans have a bottle, often more than one bottle, of ketchup in their refrigerators. It goes with very, quote-unquote, American foods or fast foods, hamburgers, French fries, chicken nuggets, you know, state fair food. It's very tasty. It's a interesting combination of sweet, salty, umami, tomatoey. It's bright in color and accents foods nicely. It cuts salt heavy, fat heavy foods really nicely, and is a great condiment. And it's something that all Americans know about, use, and feel fondly toward. It wasn't invented in the United States, but it really came of age in the United States in the late 19th century with the canning of food products and condiments, and the industrialization of the growing of tomatoes and the canning created a ubiquitous product that was marketed far and wide and then exported across the world. And it mm-hmm. now has become a fond condiment in other cultures as well. So, but it's not, Americans wouldn't call it healthy. you know, a serving is 2 tablespoons, and that 2 tablespoons has 7% of Americans' daily salt allotment, like recommended daily amount of salt. So that's pretty high for 2 tablespoons of a condiment. Mm-hmm. And even though it's tomatoes, it's not, it's nothing you would eat a huge amount of, because it's too sharp. It's a condiment. It's not meant to be eaten like tomato soup, for instance. Mm-hmm. And it's usually paired with foods that aren't the most healthy also. So, you know, fatty fried foods, French fries are fine and are beloved by Americans, but are not what we would call the good vegetables, right? We think of squash, green beans. You know, there's other healthier vegetables than potatoes. Potatoes are fine. They are actually a really good vegetable or starch, mm-hmm. as they're often categorized. But when we fry them, it loses some of their value, or it becomes embedded in less healthier cooking practices. So ketchup is loved, but we wouldn't call it a healthy vegetable to be eaten in quantities. So when the Reagan administration purportedly tried to categorize it as a vegetable and a vegetable for children, it just struck like people as very, very wrong. It's also important to understand the backdrop of school lunch at the time, which was seen as this important American democratic institution, but had gradually becoming neglected. It was underfunded. It was becoming to be appropriated by larger food industry purveyors, which were not providing the most healthy food available for kids. And so upper and middle class families were opting out of school lunch, and it became primarily consumed by lower socioeconomic children, and often children of color. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of giving ketchup as a vegetable in school lunch to primarily lower socioeconomic children just seemed, it just pushed, for most American, it pushed all their buttons, and was seen as an outrage, I think, because we love ketchup, but we don't consider it a healthy vegetable, and that the government was trying to make it consider it a vegetable for children, lower income children, just seemed so egregiously wrong.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And again, as we mentioned in the first part, this proposal didn't actually go through, right? In the end, ketchup was not allowed mm-hmm. as a substitute for a vegetable.
No, it was shot down. They withdrew that. Sorry, we didn't mean it. Just kidding. They made some other adjustments to school lunch. They implemented what's called offer versus serve. You had to have 5 components to meet the requirements of the school lunch, but children only had to choose 3 of those 5, and that was seen as a way to cut costs. And as you mentioned, Melissa, that one of the most egregious things was cutting the daily recommended allowances from what would be a third of a food allotments or calories a day to a quarter. And so just reducing the volume and amount and quality of the food for children was not given the due that it deserved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which again, as a somebody in nutrition, that's something that struck me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, taking moving now from 1981 mm-hmm. to the present, and back to your work as a historian in food. I mean, I don't need to tell you, but that these takes are super important because we can learn from the past and hopefully not make the mistakes in the present. Mm-hmm. However, in your piece, when we reach towards the end and you take us to the present, you do show us and mention some instances where we see sort of the return of the tomato paste or ketchup as a vegetable controversies. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about these recent incidences, and particularly you mentioned that in 2011, the Obama administration did something that was called more of a pizza as a vegetable proposal.
Right, right, right.
So if you can tell us more about that, and because in your piece, you didn't get to expand on it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If there were pieces that were similar, what was different about it?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So during the Obama administration, as you'll remember, Michelle Obama's one of her key signature efforts was to create healthier foods, and especially for kids. And so overhauling school lunch mm-hmm. and trying to make it healthier, trying to create standards that were higher, was a key piece of her efforts and the Obama administration's efforts. And so one component they tried to do, again, it was the tomato concentrate. They were trying to increase the minimum serving of tomato concentrate. In this case, it was tomato sauce, from 2 tablespoons to, I think, 1/4 cup. In other words, saying, if you're going to call tomato sauce a serving, it needs to be 1/4 cup instead of 2 tablespoons. We need to increase that amount and increase the quote-unquote vegetable element of it. This caused a huge furor because, of course, the frozen food pizza manufacturers, who fueled a lot of the school lunches and created frozen pizzas for school lunch, each serving of pizza did not have or would not have 1/4 cup of tomato sauce. That would probably be too much. Mm-hmm. That would probably be an amount that would be appropriate for, say, pasta, if you were going to have a pasta serving for children, but probably not on a slice of pizza. And this would throw their business into disarray. And so they fought and lobbied and lobbied and lobbied to get this component overturned, and they did. So it was called Pizza Gate. Everything's a gate. Hot pizza as a vegetable. And so the pizza manufacturers won, and 2 tablespoons was still considered a serving of tomato concentrate. I think some other, if I can just say, continue. I think another really interesting piece of the story that unfolds later on after the 1980s is what of those original recommendations ended up becoming acceptable and part of the school lunch components. So you remember the ubiquitous, the infamous pickle relish. Well, that didn't end up not counted as a vegetable. But eventually in the 1990s, salsa was considered a vegetable. A 1/4 cup, I think, a serving of salsa would indeed count as a vegetable. They were very nervous to roll this out. Lots of hemming and hawing. Well, salsa is, it's more nutritious. It's really like a vegetable salad. And it passed. It is now considered an acceptable vegetable. And I think that makes sense. I think mm-hmm. a good vegetable salsa is delicious and appropriate, and is definitely can be considered a vegetable. But they were very nervous to roll that out because, of course, that falls into the condiment category. Subsequently, nuts and nut butters and tofu have been considered acceptable protein components, which again makes total sense for us today in this day and age, and are not controversial. But in the 1980s, early 1980s, that was seen as very, very controversial, but because it felt like it superseded meat, or meat was considered a higher quality protein. So we've come a long way in hindsight to think about that those acceptable protein elements not being so controversial. The pie, the cookies, the cake things counting as grain technically should not count as grains. I don't think they do, but I'm not up on school lunches to know just how much sugar is allowed in a muffin, say. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a breakfast item. But I think it's interesting to see how we as a culture have changed through the decades to the point where we can allow a condiment like salsa to be counted as a vegetable with very little consternation, as well as protein substitutes. Ketchup is still, however, luckily not considered a vegetable. But it's still, of course, a beloved condiment by children and adults alike. And I think it still holds this important place in American culture and American consumption patterns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. But it's good that it's not counted as a vegetable. So that's...
Yes.
But I think that, you know, one of the, as somebody that works in nutrition and food policy, one of the main takeaways that I see from your work is that even though, yes, school lunches have been improving, especially after the Obama administration, even though the past administration rolled back a little, some of those provisions that they should be coming back soon. But still the issue is that we are trying to provide nutritious meals in cheap ways mm-hmm. to our kids. Mm-hmm. And I think also there is this notion, right, about how we view food versus nutrients. Mm-hmm. So you talk about this in your article, and we don't get too technical, but the idea of nutritionism mm-hmm. and how it is permeating the way we see food, and how that then leads to pizza as a vegetable or these other debacle. So can you talk a little bit about that, and also what can we learn for key lessons learned from this way of viewing food mm-hmm. for policymakers or nutrition professionals?
Yes. Yeah. As the rise of the discovery that food had these components, chemical components like vitamins, minerals, nutrients, fats, carbs, sugars, the term nutritionism refers to this idea that those are the only things that are important in food. Like if we could just inject those things into our veins, we'd be good to go. And if the most junkiest, you know, sugar cereal has vitamins in it, then of course it's okay because it's got the vitamins in it that the kid needs. We know, of course, that that's not true. That food is food. Food has those things in it, but food is more the sum of that, the total of its parts. It's got things in it that we haven't even discovered yet and thought about, and we're just learning the importance of. We're learning about the value of fermentation. We're learning about phytochemicals. We're learning about the healthy, positive aspects of the pleasures of food, the commensality, eating food together, deliciousness, taste, texture, all of these things that are embedded in food, culture, that goes so far beyond, you know, simple nutrients. And so what I think happened in school lunch, and we're still seeing the results of today, is that it just was assumed, well, if we just hand this many calories, this many vitamins, nutrients to kids, then we're good to go. And we can do it as cheaply as possible, and we don't have to worry about anything else. And of course, we know that that's a terrible way to deliver food, and it's not the healthiest, and it's not doesn't have all of these important values and cultural elements and culinary elements embedded in it. And the cheapness diminishes the healthiness of the food as well. And it's like school lunch hit rock bottom. Some of our institutional feeding institutions just have hit rock bottom in thinking that we can do this cheaply, and we know that we can't. And I think there's some element in trying to turn that around. I mean, certainly the Obama era measures were an attempt to do that, but there's a very strong industrial food lobby that's trying to fight against that, and still trying to deliver food as cheaply as possible with minimal, you know, the minimal amounts of nutrients available, you know, possible. So I think we need to think of food as food again, and mm-hmm. the important values embedded in them, and that food and lunch, school lunch and school breakfast are as important part of kids' education as other parts of the school day, and that we can find value in that, and they can benefit from that, and just think about how that translates into policy.
Yes, definitely. I think, again, just what you said, that we need to think of food as food and not just as a vehicle for nutrients, mm-hmm. and hopefully that will make better policy and avoid debacles like ketchup as a vegetable exactly. in the future.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I want to really thank you for your time and also for writing this piece for Gastronomica. And I hope that our listeners get curious about it and get to read the full article. Again, it's really interesting. All the things that you present about ketchup and the policy context and lessons that we can learn for today. Mm. So thank you, Amy, for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Melissa. It's really been fun to chat with you and to chat about the moment in time, the infamous ketchup as a vegetable incident.
Good. So we don't forget about that.
Exactly.
So thank you. And for our listeners, this episode will be the last in the series. And Gastronomica will return in the coming weeks to future works from our next issue, 21.2. Listeners can read the full article in Gastronomica Journal for Food Studies, volume 21.1, in February. And for more details, visit gastronomica.org. Thank you.
Meant to Be Eaten is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.